Okay, picture this. It's late, right? You're tired. Cooking dinner feels like, I don't know, climbing a mountain.
Yeah, totally been there.
So you grab your phone, tap, tap, tap. 20 minutes later, food arrives in a box. Need fulfilled.
Instant gratification.
Exactly. You maybe scarf it down watching something, and boom, nourishment is done. But was it really nourishing?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it?
We've sort of boiled eating down to this fast, efficient transaction. And the sources we're diving into today, drawing from ideas and works like Fractal and the Oracle 2.0, stuff about holistic systems, they say this is actually quite dangerous. They argue food is fundamentally a relationship, not just, calories or fuel.
That's really the heart of it for this deep dive. When that relationship breaks down, when you're just consuming, not connecting with the food, it's not just about your
It's
diet.
bigger.
Oh, much bigger. It reflects a wider disconnection, personally and societally. So our mission today is to unpack this idea that moving away from ultra-processed food isn't just about health. It's a sacred act, an act of alignment.
Alignment, like that fractal idea, how we do the small things mirrors the big things.
Precisely. How we nourish ourselves, that small-scale action, it reflects our larger reality. So how we eat is how we are, essentially.
Okay, that's a really interesting frame. So where do we start? I guess we need to look at how big this problem actually is.
Definitely. Because convenience, for many of us, isn't just nice to have anymore.
No, it feels necessary. It's just the pace of life dictates it.
Exactly. And ultra-processed foods, UPFs, they didn't just stumble into success. They were engineered to fill what our sources call the ecosystem of disconnection.
Ecosystem of disconnection. What does that mean exactly?
Well, think about modern life. Cities, specialized jobs, the constant rush. It creates this vacuum. We need things fast, cheap, convenient.
And UPFs fill that vacuum perfectly.
Perfectly. Cheap, shelf-stable, quick to prepare or eat. They were basically designed for a population that's always short on time.
And the result, I mean, the numbers are just mind-blowing.
You really are a wake-up call. In the U.S., UPFs make up something like 73% of the entire food supply. 73%.
Wow, that's most of it.
And if you look at where our actual calories are coming from, it's stark. The U.S. gets almost 59% of its energy from UPFs.
59%.
Yeah, the U.K. is around 57%, Canada just under 48%. It's dominant.
Okay, hold on. Let's connect that back to the fractal idea. If nearly three quarters of our food supply, the literal stuff we build ourselves with, is engineered for speed and profit, not vitality, what does that say about the large scale, our society, our collective focus,
Yeah.
our resilience?
It suggests, well, systemic fragility, doesn't it? A system running on these highly processed, maybe even brittle inputs.
And it gets worse because it's not just us. It's becoming the norm for kids.
That's the truly worrying part. It's intergenerational. U.S. data shows kids and teens aged 1 to 18 get almost 62% of their calories from UPFs.
62%. That's even higher than adults.
Significantly higher.
Yeah.
Adults are around 53%. This isn't just a phase. It's like we're normalizing a long-term disorder for the next generation. It's setting their baseline.
And the way these foods play into economics is, well, it's complex.
It really is. It sort of profits at both ends. In wealthy countries, UPFs are often pushed as the budget-friendly option, targeting lower socioeconomic groups.
Right, the affordability angle.
But then you look internationally in lower and middle-income countries, places like Brazil or Mexico. There, consuming these imported branded packaged foods can actually be seen as a sign of moving up economically. It's aspirational, modern.
So it's desirable there for different reasons. Wow.
And the economic incentive is strong. One report found just a 10% rise in income leads to an 11% jump in demand for imported UPFs.
They've got us coming and going. So when we talk about willpower, maybe that's the wrong frame entirely.
I think it often is. It's easy to blame individuals, but this is sophisticated food science. It's an engineered hook.
The engineered hook. Okay, break that down.
These foods are deliberately designed in labs. They're meant to be hyper-palatable, habit-forming. Food scientists work incredibly hard to find that perfect mix of salt, sugar, fat.
That's the bliss point, right?
That's the one, the bliss
He
point.
sounds nice, bliss, but you're saying it's actually hijacking our brains.
Pretty much. It bypasses our normal signals for fullness, for satiety. Hitting that bliss point gives the brain this massive, rapid flood of dopamine.
The pleasure chemical.
Right. It feels good, really good. But it's so fast, and often without the actual bulk or fiber your body needs, that the spike is followed by a really sharp crash.
Ah, the crash. And that makes you want more.
Exactly. The craving kicks in hard. You're chasing the pleasure, the stimulation, not actual hunger or nutritional need. It's a cycle.
And there was something about the combination making it even more addictive.
Yes, the supra-additive effect. That's crucial. A big review in 2023 showed that the specific combination of refined carbs and fats found in most UPFs, well, it's got a much stronger addictive potential than either one on its own.
So it's like 1 + 1 = 5, not 2.
Kind of, yeah. It's synergistic. The effect is amplified.
And how does that compare to other addictive things? You mentioned the speed.
Right. The speed of delivery matters. Think about fast-acting drugs like cocaine. They hit the brain hard and fast, which increases their addictive power.
Okay.
This combination of refined carbs and fats together acts similarly fast on the brain's reward pathways. It essentially bypasses the body's usual checks and balances.
Which leads to the comparison that some of these foods might be as addictive as cigarettes. Or even cocaine.
That's the conclusion some research is pointing towards, yes.
Yeah.
The mechanisms can be disturbingly similar.
That is incredibly serious. If we're dealing with something potentially as addictive as cocaine, are we really equipped to handle it just by telling people to, you know, eat mindfully?
That's a really important challenge. And the sources absolutely push us to see the clinical side of this is a physiological hijack.
Uh-huh.
And it gets tangled up with memory, too. Childhood food memories.
Mm-hmm.
Incredibly powerful drivers. Plus, studies show people with patterns of food addiction actually have weaker inhibitory control.
Meaning?
Meaning the sheer tastiness, the palatability, can literally override their conscious decision to stop eating. The urge is stronger than the intention.
So the solutions need to be just as potent as the problem, addressing the brain chemistry, not just the behavior.
Exactly. Which we definitely need to get into. But first, let's talk costs. Beyond addiction, what does this diet do to us? Physically and emotionally.
Right. Because it's not just about weight, is it?
Not at all. The hidden costs are huge, starting with chronic inflammation. Systemic inflammation.
Okay, inflammation. We hear that word a lot. What does it mean in this context?
Think of your body's immune system. When it encounters things it doesn't recognize or sees as harmful, chemical additives, weird fats, loads of refined sugar, it mounts a defense.
Like fighting off an infection.
Sort of. But the problem is, with UPFs, the invaders keep coming, meal after meal. So the immune response never turns off. It becomes chronic, low-grade inflammation throughout your whole body.
And that's bad.
It's linked to almost every major chronic illness. Mm. Heart disease, type 2 diabetes, even some cancers. It's a foundational driver of modern disease.
Wow. And where does the gut fit into this?
The gut is ground zero. UPS can absolutely wreck your gut microbiome, the community of bacteria living in your intestines.
Wipes out the good guys.
Exactly. It decreases diversity, kills beneficial bacteria. This disruption can lead to leaky gut syndrome.
Leaky gut. Okay, I've heard that. What's actually leaking?
Imagine your gut lining is like a very tight fence, only letting specific things through. Leaky gut means that fence gets damaged, becomes more porous.
Holes in the fence.
Kind of. And through those gaps, undigested food bits, toxins, microbial waste can leak directly into your bloodstream where they don't belong.
And the body reacts?
Big time. The immune system sees these things in the blood as threats, triggering even more inflammation. But now, it's body-wide.
And this gut inflammation, it doesn't stay in the gut, does it? The gut-brain connection?
Yeah, absolutely. It doesn't stay in the gut. The gut and brain are constantly talking. Mainly via the vagus nerve. It's a two-way street.
So an unhappy gut means?
An unhappy brain. Often. An inflamed gut sends distress signals straight upstairs. That's why poor gut health is strongly linked to mood disorders, anxiety, brain fog, poor psychological function overall. You can't really separate gut health and mental health.
Which brings us straight to the emotional side of things. Using these foods as like an emotional band-aid.
Yeah, the crutch for emotions. We reach for that salty, sugary, fatty hit when we feel stressed, bored, anxious, lonely.
A quick fix.
A quick temporary fix that does nothing to solve the underlying feeling. And this is where the idea of a spiritual famine comes in.
Spiritual famine? How so?
When eating is just mindless consumption, just a transaction, we lose the connection. Connection to where the food came from, the process, the ritual of nourishment. That loss creates this deeper kind of hunger, this void.
Yeah, we mistake for physical hunger.
Exactly. We keep trying to fill that spiritual emptiness with more processed calories, but it never works. It's the wrong kind of nourishment.
It's a cycle, a really damaging one.
A perfect storm, really. Society feels disconnected, which causes emotional pain. We soothe the pain with UPFs. The UPFs damage our gut.
The damaged gut inflames the body and brain, worsening mental health.
Which makes us crave the UPFs even more. deepening the addiction and the disconnection. It's a self-reinforcing loop of, well, self-sabotage.
Okay, that's a bleak picture. But if the problem is systemic, the solution has to be too, right? How do we break out? How do we start rebuilding that relationship?
We start with something that sounds simple, but is actually quite radical in today's world. Mindful eating.
Mindful eating. Not a diet, then.
Definitely not a diet. It's more like a meditative practice. It's about paying full attention, without judgment, to the experience of eating.
How does that help with the brain hijacking we talked about?
It's like neurological retraining, or alchemy, as one source put it. By savoring natural foods, you teach your brain to find pleasure in subtle flavors and textures, not just the intense hit of the bliss point. You rewire the reward pathways.
Okay, so how do you actually do it? Give us the practical steps.
Start small. First, engage your senses before you even eat. Look at the food, the colors, shapes. Smell it. Notice the texture.
Yep.
Then, slow. Way down. Chew properly. Put your fork or spoon down between bites. This gives your body time to send those I'm getting full signals to your brain.
Signals that UPFs are designed to short circuit.
Precisely.
Mm.
And crucially, eliminate distractions. Turn off the TV. Put the phone away. Just eat.
Easier said than done sometimes, isn't it? Eating at your desk, grabbing something on the go.
Absolutely. And that's where the no judgment part is key. It's not about perfection. It's about intention. Every mindful bite is a win. Don't beat yourself up if some meals are rushed. Aim for progress, not flawless execution.
Okay, that makes sense. What's next after mindfulness?
The second big step is a return to the source, choosing whole foods, things that look like they did when they came out of the ground or off the tree.
Less processing, more nature.
Exactly. And part of that is reframing cooking. See it not as a burden, but maybe as a creative act, a way to directly rebuild that relationship with food, right in your own kitchen, chopping, stirring, smelling. It's a full sensory experience.
So mindfulness and whole foods, what about managing those intense cravings, the triggers?
Right, we need practical tools for that. Strategic antidotes. One really powerful one is food and mood journaling.
Writing it down.
Yep. What did you eat? And just as important, how did you feel before, during, after? Emotionally, physically, you start to see patterns. Oh, when I feel stressed, I reach for X. That awareness gives you power.
The power to make a different choice next time.
Exactly. And simple strategic planning helps too. Shop with a list. Don't shop hungry, big mistake.
Guilty.
We all are. Keep healthy stuff visible and ready to go at home. Make the easy choice, the healthy choice. Structure helps willpower.
And changing how we think about it. You mentioned reframing.
Yeah, ditch the I cheated on my diet guilt. Healthy eating isn't a test you fail. It's more like a puzzle. How can I navigate this situation with wisdom and flexibility today? Be kind to yourself.
That feels more sustainable. But what about those cases where it is a serious addiction, where self-help isn't enough?
That's the clinical reality we have to acknowledge. For severe cases, professional help is often essential. And therapists are adapting tools from other addiction fields.
Like what?
Well, cognitive behavioral therapy enhanced, or CBTE, it's got strong evidence originally for eating disorders, but it's very applicable here.
How does CBTE work for this?
It digs into the why. What are the underlying thoughts and feelings driving the behavior? It helps people manage difficult emotions without using food, develop coping skills for triggers, and challenge restrictive or chaotic eating patterns.
So therapy can really help untangle it.
Absolutely. And for some, depending on the severity, approaches like harm reduction or even strict abstinence protocols similar to substance abuse treatment might be explored with a professional. It needs to be treated seriously.
Okay. So we've gone from the problem to practical steps and even clinical help. What's the final piece? You mentioned something about a sacred bite.
Ah, yes. This is about shifting perspective fundamentally.
Yeah.
Viewing eating not just as fuel, not just as mindful practice, but as a sacred act.
Yeah.
Every single time.
As sacred. How do you mean?
It's about cultivating deep gratitude. Gratitude for the food itself, for the earth that grew it, the sun, the water, the hands that harvested it, prepared it, the whole chain of life.
That sounds like a ritual.
It is. Think about traditional cultures. The Japanese tea ceremony, Sado, it's incredibly precise, mindful, respectful. Or think about making tamales together in Mexico. It's communal, it strengthens bonds, passes down traditions through food.
So food as connection, not just consumption.
Exactly. Connection to source, to others, to tradition, to life itself.
And for the listener, how can they bring that into a busy life? Maybe without a full tea ceremony.
You can be incredibly simple. A moment of silence before eating, taking one deep conscious breath, silently saying thank you. These tiny rituals transform a potentially mindless act into something powerful, a small rebellion against that autopilot mode.
A rebellion against disconnection.
That's really what this deep dive has shown, isn't it? The issue with processed food goes way beyond just bad ingredients. It taps into our emotional state, our spiritual well-being.
Yeah, the forces pushing us towards autopilot living are the same ones that turn food into just another transaction. Mm-hmm. But that fractal principle works both ways. Every moment you choose awareness, every bite you choose with intention, that's an act of pushing back. It's alignment.
Choosing conscious nourishment becomes this microcosmic awakening. A better, more connected you helps create a better, more connected world.
It starts on your plate.
It really can. But given everything we've discussed, the power of childhood habits, those shocking youth consumption stats, 62%, this awakening needs to start much earlier now. It has to be more intentional to counter what's become normalized.
So the final thought for everyone listening.
The most critical question, especially if you influence children's eating, is this. How does your journey towards conscious nourishment translate into conscious parenting? How do we protect the next generation from inheriting this disconnection?